to the Circumference podcast series. I'm Montana Ray, and today I'm so excited to be talking to Idra Novi. Idra, perhaps we can start with talking about the relationship between your poetry practice and your translation practice.
I think that translating gets me out of certain habits about how I put poems together. And every time you translate someone, you have to say, what is their notion of a poem? What is it that they're doing that makes the poems hang together? And by imaginative leap into that way of putting a poem together, it expands the way that you make poems. Because you, by saying, oh, this is how this poem was hanging together, this is how this poet makes the poems create some sort of a coherent whole or an incoherent whole, whatever they're aiming for, then you learn how to create a new kind of incoherence or a new kind of coherence, because it forces you to make that imaginative leap. Mm-hmm. And I love that. I think it has expanded the way that I approach poem making.
I know that also you use translation as a way to get going into the writing during the day, yeah. Practically schedule-wise.
Yeah.
There's also...
Sometimes, right, you get there in the morning, whenever it is that you have time to work on a poem, and if I can't sort of get into like that poetry brain space, I'll translate for an hour, and then I'll get excited about something I'm translating, want to write back to one of the lines, or some rhythm in it, or some sound, or some interesting leap that happened that I was fascinated with, and then I find I get into poems. I think I write more because I translate.
Yeah.
I think it keeps me writing.
Right.
Which is a great thing.
It's awesome.
And not repeating myself, which I think happens a lot in American poetry, or poetry
yeah.
in general, that people keep writing, but sometimes their poems start to sound alike, and I would like to not do that, because I don't want to bore myself. More than anyone else. Mm-hmm. You know, I like surprises. I like to surprise myself with what I can write and like what I can. And I think that it's more likely for me to sort of create different kinds of poems by like translating different kinds of poets, which is why I haven't actually translated the same poet each time I've done different poems.
Oh, interesting.
I just think there are different things to learn from each person I translate.
Great. And can you talk a little bit about the translation history, the movement from poet to novelist?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's funny. Once you get... At first, I think as a translator, you seek out things, and then people seek you out as you're known as somebody who translates. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of how I ended up translating fiction. I didn't actually seek that out. Mm-hmm. The publishers sought out me, and then I ended up doing those books, which I really enjoyed, except for the deadline part. But with poetry, there are no deadlines, because there are no poetry emergencies in that way.
Right.
There is, you know, no market to be, exploited, so take your time, which is fantastic. So what happened was, I've been an editor for a long time with this magazine, Radiplax, and it was published in Chile and in Brazil and distributed in all three places, and we had a Brazilian editor, Flavia Rocha, who became a friend. And we did a couple co-translations together, and she introduced me to Brazilian poets. And so that was how I found the work of Paulo Henrique Brito. Mm-hmm. And then I mm-hmm. went on and did the book, the Birds for Demolition book. Mm-hmm. So she was really keen in introducing me, since she was in Brazil and knew what was happening there. Mm-hmm. She introduced me to tons of poets who I did a couple poems here or there for the magazine. Mm-hmm. But these were two that just, I was so fascinated with their work and just love spending time with it. I kind of got addicted to their poems.
Yeah.
And I feel like when you feel that sort of like a somewhat healthy addiction feeling, like mm-hmm. you can't get enough of them, that's a good sign that you are interested in work enough to do 2 or 3 years on it and do the whole book.
Idra, would you pick a poem to read from The Clean Shirt of It, your translations of poems by Paulo Henrique Brito?
Brito is a translator himself. He's translated over 100 books. He was... really understanding about the leaps that a poet has to do in order to translate poetry, because he's done it himself. And there is nothing like translating a translator. It's great. So anyway, this is one of the ones where I made a bunch of changes, but because he's alive and I could ask him, I felt a little more liberty to do so. Phalange. Our arrival is gradual, discreet, but we're certain as 6 and 7 make 13. The hour doubles itself, heightens as we drive past, ever smug and rounding up silences. We're severe, as complete as 6 and 2 make 0. We don't have promises or feet. When we come, it is for always. We arrive fully stocked. Don't talk, don't be, don't try it.
And here is Paulo Henrique Brito reading Phalange in Portuguese.
Phalange. Chegamos aos poucos, discretos, mas somos certos. Tão certos como 2 e 5 e 7. A hora se dobra sobre nós quando passamos soberbos, arrebanhando silêncios. Somos severos, completos, como 6 e 2 e 0. Não temos mãos nem promessas. Quando vimos é para sempre. Chegamos abastecidos. Não fale, não seja, não tente.
You're listening to the Circumference podcast series. That was Paulo Enriquez Brito reading his poem Falange, which is translated by Idra Novi in The Clean Shirt of It, published by BOA. Idra, could you tell me about your relationship with Brito?
He was a wonderful poet to work with for the first time I did a full collection, because mm-hmm. he was a translator, because he mm-hmm. was really available. It's like always on email and would mm-hmm. email me back when I was really stuck on something mm-hmm. and would give me some insights into how he wrote the poem or mm-hmm. what he was thinking about, and it would help me make better choices on how to translate mm-hmm. the poem. So it was wonderful to translate somebody who was alive, who was also really supportive and flexible. Mm-hmm. That is an ideal situation. Because Manuel de Bajos, I was a more experienced translator when I did that book, mm-hmm. and I didn't have as much contact with him. He doesn't use email. He's, I think, 164 years old. And he lives, you know, in the wetlands of Brazil. So we didn't have much contact. And that book was tricky for different reasons. He uses a lot of words in there that are sort of from, you know, indigenous languages spoken in that region of Brazil, or that are specific to the flora or fauna of the wetlands of Brazil. And so finding equivalent words in English was tricky, because we don't have those fungi. Mm-hmm. We don't have those animals. We don't have those flowers. But the vividness of that specificity mm-hmm. is part of the beauty of the poems. Mm-hmm. So that was fun to sort of figure out what to do. I like impossible things.
Idra, would you read from the book Birds for a Demolition, your translations of Manuel Gibarus? Would you read the poem In War?
Sure. In War. The mayor dispatched a messenger by horse with a letter to the emperor. The letter announced the city had been invaded by Paraguayan troops and expressed a need for extra recourses. 2 months later, the messenger handed the letter to the emperor. When the recourses arrived, the Paraguayans were no longer there. The emperor's men came with 15 young women and a few provisions to eat on the way. I guess they ate them all. Corumbá is a city whose population is well mixed with Paraguayans. It's a cheeky poem.
You're listening to the Circumference podcast series. That was Idra Novi reading her translation of Manuel Gibarus, On War, from Birds for a Demolition. Idra, would you talk about your most recent translation project, Clarissa Spector's The Passion According to G.H.?
I love Clarissa Spector. She was one of the reasons I learned Portuguese, mm-hmm. because I read her work in college and was so blown away by it. And knew, because I spoke Spanish, that Portuguese wouldn't be too much of a leap, mm-hmm. that I really wanted to know what it was like to read her in the original, and eventually took Portuguese classes for a while, and eventually moved to Brazil. I mean, at that point, my interest in Brazil was, you know, beyond the spectrum, but I do think it was kind of what triggered it.
Great.
And so when Barbara Epler approached me about translating one of these La Spectra, I was sort of like, well, this is sort of the project of a lifetime. So mm-hmm. I was so excited mm-hmm. to do it. And this is my favorite book of hers. And mm-hmm. it just happened that they chose me to do this one. So it was sort of this, you know, dreamy situation. So I'll read, there's a warning that she puts in to potential readers at the beginning of the book, which is really fun. This is what she says. To potential readers, this book is like any other book, but I would be happy if it was only read by people whose souls are already formed. Those who know that the approach of whatever it may be is done gradually and painstakingly, passing through even the opposite of what it's going to approach. Those who, and only they, will slowly come to understand that this book doesn't demand anything of anyone. For me, for example, the character G.H. went on giving, little by little, a difficult joy. But it is called joy. It's kind of an amazing Ars Poetica, isn't it? Because writing is a difficult joy. But it is a joy.
She's so direct. We sometimes, poets, we have the most intimate art form, and then you read something like that, and you're, I don't know. It just,
but for me, this was like translating poetry, but it was like 180 pages of poetry, because each line is so mysterious and spare, and it's both direct and yet completely out there. Mm-hmm. And I love that she can do that. I think, you know, I rewrote my second book of poems after translating her. Wow. I think it really changed my voice. And I organized the second book poems with a sentence from her.
Yeah.
You know, because I think it was just in my mind. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't, subject-wise or what I was writing about wasn't, but I just think that I loved how she could do that, how mm-hmm. there are these lines that are so mysterious, and yet they feel frank and direct. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how she does that to make things seem both incredibly clear and incredibly remote.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. That there's this intimacy, but it's totally false because we have no actual connection between the like the author and the reader, really, other than this weird Neptunian planet of her book.
Brito, in fact, told me this anecdote. I was saying to him that when I first read Le Spectre, I had this feeling like she was someone that I would totally get me, and that I would get her, and that we had this extremely special, deep, intimate connection that I felt from reading her work. Which, of course, is always one way, but this was in college. And Brito says that everyone feels that way when they read Le Spectre. Mm-hmm. And then he knew of a young woman who contacted Le Spectre and wanted to be a writer and wanted to meet her because she also felt that there was some sort of aesthetic or sensibility that they had in common. And she went to Le Spectre's house, and Spectre just sat there in silence and stared at her until the woman cried and fled.
She's like, actually, maybe we're not soulmates after all.
But I think that was really interesting because that is a mistake I think you can make as a reader, a wonderful mistake, that your connection is with the work, not necessarily the person who created the work.
Right.
But that's such an amazing thing to do as a writer, is to make people feel that you get them on some intimate, profound level. So I think that's what's so phenomenal about her work.
And it's definitely promoted by, I just had looked online at the covers for the book and how they
all make her face together to make her face. Isn't that wild?
It's wild.
I know. It's a great design.
It's beautiful. Yeah. But it's playing on people's desire to piece together who she is. She's like a beautiful woman, too. It's very seductive, that design.
And, I mean, G.H. is basically about a woman's sort of blindness to herself and to who she is in society and to the woman who was employed in her house. Mm-hmm. And it's very much about classism, who you see and who you... Her maid quits and flees, and she realizes she can't remember the maid's name. The woman's been living in her house. Wow. That's how the book begins. So it's really interesting that the part of Le Spectre's face that's on the book is not her eye.
Right.
It's like her chin.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It seemed, you know, I don't think enough the designer had that in mind, but I felt like that was quite
appropriate. I feel like they probably did.
Her eyes.
Yeah. Idra, were there any touchstones or other writers you looked to when trying to capture Le Spectre's voice?
I think of her, I sort of love outsider art and folk art and art that people are making without sort of going through the sort of writing workshops or art workshops that I make a living teaching. And I think she's like that. And people say that she wasn't actually sort of like a rigorous reader who was constantly pouring and writing back to things that she read. I think that she just had this voice and it came out of her. To try and translate her that way, to just really interact with the words and not with putting her into some sort of like box, which is why I think it also took a long time for her work to get the reception it deserves. One, because she's a woman. Two, because she's from Brazil, and I don't think we, as an international community, we're not really quick to put women writers, especially Latin American women writers, into the canon of must-read international literature.
Right.
So I think that's one thing. But I also think because her voice is so different, and you can't say she is the, you know, as some people say in the rude, she is the Kafka of, you know, this of modern day Cervantes. You know, like people often put together like a couple different male writers or even any kind of writers and say that that's how you explain who somebody is. She's the Le Spectre of Le Spectre.
Idra, you talked a little about being inspired to start learning Portuguese because of Le Spectre, but you're completely bilingual in Spanish. Why the impulse, other than Le Spectre, to translate poetry in Portuguese?
I knew a lot of the poets in Chile. They didn't seem quite as exciting to me.
Right.
And I didn't find any poets there that I felt this thing that they fed me as a poet.
Right.
And I just really loved Brito's work and felt like I had a lot to learn from it as a poet. And then I started realizing that I really liked writing sort of surrealist poems myself. And I think the tradition of doing that in the U.S. isn't quite as strong as it is in other languages.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really liked Bajos's use of surrealism, where he kind of has surrealist elements, but then the poem will slip into realism and then slip back into surrealism. And I liked that movement back and forth between the two of them.
Right.
And so I really enjoyed working with that. And they just both happened to be Brazilian. Like, the next book I translate may not be.
Right.
But that was just what I was really interested in as a poet. And so that's what I was compelled to spend time translating, you know? Yeah.
Idra, you're also a fabulous teacher, and at Columbia you oversaw the development of a program for a dual MFA where writers could work in their own genre and also translate. And so what would you say to a young writer who is just starting out in the field of translation?
I think there's this fear in the United States, at least, of translation, and that it's an inferior creative act to the act of original writing, and that there's some sort of finite amount of time and that it will take away from your writing. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that's the case in other countries. I think people see it as almost inevitable that if you're a writer, you'll also translate, both for financial reasons and also for craft reasons. You'll just be a better writer for it. And so I think that dispelling that myth and not seeing translation as a part of one's development as a writer, and to stop repeating oneself, and to challenge the kind of voices you can take on the page, will make you a better writer, as opposed to seeing it as taking away from your writing time, or maybe it will jeopardize some voice that you've come up with, and that you'll suddenly start writing like someone else. But I don't really think that happens. I don't understand where that fear comes from. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's in some way some sort of xenophobia that's driving it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Elliot Weimer has a great essay, Anonymous Sources, where he says that the 1960s was a really fertile period for American poetry, and there's a lot of innovation. And he attributes to how many poets lived in other countries, mm-hmm. and how many poets translated. Mm-hmm. And then as people became more academicized and were in academies and they were just teaching and writing and not either traveling or translating, that things got a little more static. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping, with all the translators that I've worked with, that everyone says, what should I do after I do the MFA? And I was like, get a suitcase or a backpack and get out of here.
Get out of here.
Idra, I want to talk about your own poetry, your latest book, Exit Civilian. Could you start by reading a poem from the book, perhaps one that has to do with Lispector?
This poem is a response to Lispector's novel, which is translated into English as The Apple in the Dark. And I used for the title of the poem the Portuguese original title, which is A Massa no Escuro. What goes missing in the story is not a weapon, but the crime. A fugitive arrives at a farm in the far Sertão of Brazil. The two lonely sisters who live there and have never left it say, yes, sir, some help with their hens and the broken fence there would be fine. A few apples fall, the corn grows taller. The man sweeps out the silo, and a brightness seeps into the sisters, their hands assuming new meanings in the simple opening of canisters, their manicured fingers feeling around the sides. When the police arrive with the description, one sister flinches, the other closes her eyes. Only one has to say it, Deus meu, he's in our barn.
You're listening to Idra Novi read from her book, Exit Civilian. Idra, I wondered if you felt aligned in that book with the project of Edward Galeano and also Elliot Weinberger, although they undertake it from very different styles and directions. But I see their project being to point out the simultaneity of events, or even the interconnectedness of events.
I think the beauty of living abroad is that you realize that we do have connected fates, mm-hmm. and that there is no fate that could never possibly be yours. Mm-hmm. And that there's certain things that couldn't possibly happen to you because of who you are. I think that's just a false sense of certainty, that anything can happen to all of us, you know? And because of that, I think it gives you perhaps some sort of, I would hope, compassion, that when really crappy things happen to other people, or that every injustice is the injustice for all of us, because we are sort of all on the same human team, as much of a cliche as that is. And so I think for me, because I've lived in a number of countries and I'm always translating and traveling, that I always want my books to just go beyond. Like, this book was much more American, I think, in a way than my first book of poems, but that was why I really wanted to have that kind of coda of the last section of the book, which are poems about prisons in Chile and Brazil, because I've been to those prisons, and I wanted to do exactly what you're saying, which is to always say what I'm talking about here, even if this is sort of more American, is something that's happening elsewhere, and that shows you how universal it is and how connected our human impulses are, and that they're everywhere in different forms. So yeah, I'm totally flattered. I think Eduardo Galeano and Elliot Weinberg are extremely internationally minded, mm-hmm. writers, and I would hope to always be so too, because I think connections beyond the domestic are fascinating to me.
Idra, would you read some of the City Library poems which are scattered throughout the book Exit Civilian?
This is the first in that series. It's called Titles in the City Library Search for Prisons, U.S. End of Education in 2,
Famous Escapes from 109, Gangrene in 1, Gangs in Feature Films on 63, Hospitals in 2, Hulks in Feature Films on 13, Overcrowding in 1, Ozzy Osbourne in 7, Stones and 1, Stonewalling and See Also Henry Kissinger 4. And this is from the same series later in the book. Titles in the City Library, Search for Women's Prisons, U.S. Handcuffed During Labor in 2, Whores in Feature Films on 45. Mental Illness in 3, Witches and Spells in 26. Religious Education in 58. Elimination of College Education in, see also William J. Clinton, 2. Ukuleles in, see also They Always Call Us Ladies, 4.
Idra, can you tell me about teaching writing in prison?
When I taught in prison, I never knew what any of my prisoners' crimes were for a long time until they became, you know, a lot of them were older than I was, and they became friends or students that I was, you know, close with, just like I am with my, was with my students at Columbia and other places I've taught. And when I did find out their crimes, I had a really hard time kind of reconciling these people who I came to know as writers and poetry workshops, and then with these things that they had done. And I also realized that, you know, we are all capable in a certain kind of panic and desperation of doing terrible things, and to think that you would never do that, I think, again, is like this false sense of certainty. So I kind of wanted to have this book all be about that blurring, because I felt it myself. And I wrote all these poems sort of sitting on the subway. I would start them after when I was leaving the prison, or I would go out for dinner with friends when I finished my class, because I would be downtown, and I would have an hour, and I would just, that transition from being behind all those beeping doors to the other rest of the world was so disorienting that I would have to kind of write my way out of it. It became this mix of surrealism and realism because it felt surreal to me.
Right.
It was reality, but it didn't quite feel real. It was so crazy.
Could you read House Arrest from Exit Civilian?
House Arrest. When punishment became a picture frame, the state gave our mother a glittering one and some picture wire so she could hover properly on the wall. Neighbors asked if the stillness had been in her before, if we poured our milk differently over our cereal with our mother always fixed there and listening. After weeks of such inquiries, we said enough and climbed in with her. Why not be miserable together? For fun, we picked the glitter off her picture frame. Sometimes we ate it for dinner.
Thank you, Idra. Who's the mother in these poems?
For me, for a long time, the mother was always the other. Mm-hmm. That I was the daughter, and I would sort of judge what my mother had done or not done for me as a mother. Mm-hmm. And so I think in some ways, when I became a mother, I could no longer think of the mother as the other.
Right.
I was, and so since whenever I was talking about sort of the mother is like an archetype, once you have children, you are that archetype. And anyone who's hearing you read could think that you are the mother being referred to, and it's no longer assumed that you, that the mother is someone who is not you. Just the same way that the prisoner is someone who is not you, or the criminal is someone who is
exactly.
not you. And so the fact that those things happen at the same time, that notion that, you know, I was realizing that the notion of thinking the prisoner is a criminal is the other is so false. Yeah. And also seeing the mother as someone who was not me was false. Was, I think they just changed the way that I read. And when things change the way that you read, they change the way you write. Mm-hmm. So I think that's sort of something I was kind of figuring out for myself as I was working on these, I think.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah. There was like, none, all the others were gone.
Yeah.
They were just gone. They were all me.
Idra, your first book, The Next Country, was picked in chapbook form by Carolyn Frasche. I see your work in dialogue with her work. Even the titles, The Next Country and her book, The Country Between Us, have a resonance for me. Do you agree?
Her life was an inspiration to me when I was, you know, starting to work on poetry. It continues to be. And I didn't meet her until the night of the chapbook reading.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had read her work and loved that she had, you know, traveled to Salvador, and it was very interested in human rights issues, and that was a motivation for her as a poet and as a translator. And, you know, she translated Claudia de la Alegría, and that, I think, helped her form sort of who she was as a poet. Mm-hmm. So I was very inspired by the life she created as a poet. And I saw that, and saw that as something that I sort of wanted to try and do my own way with, you know, my own interests. And so the fact that she ended up being one of the judges for the PSA chapbook and chose it was, like, so dreamy and amazing. And then I couldn't sleep the last couple nights before the chapbook reading because I was so excited to meet her.
I also see you occupying a similar space, politically and aesthetically. Do you see a similarity in the roles you play in Gringolandia or a U.S. poetry community?
One is sort of presented with this thought that if you take on social realities or political realities and you talk about more than, like, you know, some animal that's been killed on the side of the road as some sort of darkness or something, that you're in danger of writing something that won't be timeless or that won't speak to certain people or come across as having an agenda or an argument or something. And I just wanted to write about the things that sort of seemed that connected all of us. And those are often, unfortunately, terrible injustices that happen to different people in different places and could happen to ourselves. And she writes about that, but not at the expense of lyricism. And no one could make that case about her work.
And she's self-referential. She's political and self-referential.
It's very brave to be that on the page, to not hide either of those things, you know?
I think reading her work made me braver. I think that there are, when as a young poet, she's an important voice to read for that reason, in a way. But she also did another amazing thing for me, and we've stayed in touch. She's just a great inspiration for many reasons, and she had wrote an intro for the chapbook, mm-hmm. where she kind of articulated what the poems were doing, mm-hmm. and how they connected, and I didn't see that until she told me.
Oh, that's awesome.
That was great, and I think that helped me finish the rest of the first book. Because mm-hmm. I was like, oh, as soon as she said it, I was like, oh, that's what these poems have in common. And she talked about how the word country was a metaphor. In some ways, maybe because she had also used it as a metaphor. Mm-hmm. But she saw these connections among the poems that I'd written that I hadn't seen and no one else had pointed out. Mm-hmm. And from there, I just wrote the rest of the first book because I got it. Yeah. I think because we had never met and she didn't know anything about me except for those poems she got in this manuscript, that she just responded to them in a different way. And it was like, it was exactly what I needed to hear to figure out where to go from next.
Idra, I feel like there's a pretty strong coalition of women who are supporting your work. Patricia Smith selected Exit Civilian as the winner of the National Poetry Series.
I think in a way, the fact that Carolyn Forché and Patricia Smith both recognized my work, what was more important to me than the fact that they were women is that they're poets I admire. And I learned so much from their work and found that the risks that they took were really important to me and helped me take risks with the kind of things that I wanted to risk as a poet. So I think what was so exciting for me about having both of them choose my work wasn't that they were women, but that they were poets that I really admire.
Could you talk more about the kinship you feel with Patricia Smith's work? Had you read her book, Blood Dazzler?
I actually went back and read it after she chose my book. I had read it, but had in the saw that we had this interesting way of taking on a material and then kind of coming at it from the side. And I didn't see that as a model when I was working on the book, but once she chose my book and I went back and looked at it, I was like, oh, we both really like to sneak into the material from the side. And I think that that's something that I like to do. Like, you take on something and it's loaded, but the way that you can sort of do it in a way that doesn't put off your reader and doesn't sort of compromise your art or the aesthetics you bring to it is by getting at it through a dog or through a prison that's sassy and talks back, which is what I did, but sort of trying to get at something that's loaded in a way that's sort of like through a crack in the floor.
Idra, would you read some of the Little Prison series, please?
Enter the little prison a comma, and you come out a question mark. Enter a scallop, and you come out the shell. Enter in English, and you come out murmuring what your great-grandmother murmured to other shells on another shore. Enter an apple, and come out the teeth marks in its yellowed core. There are no hardcover books for inhabitants of the little prison. They might open them. They might find the lingams of Sai Baba or a glimmering orange moon, which may eclipse, and no one will alert the little prison. And this is its secret. The little prison was once a field. Herds of deer moved across and flocks of herons. Their calls rose and echoed. In the spring, if pressed, the little prison that was once a field will admit it once likened itself to the great amphitheater at Delphi.
In the book, there's a specific reference to Simic's translations of Vasco Popa's The Little Box. Could you talk a little bit about that as an inspiration for The Little Prison?
I read that poem, I think when I was in grad school, so it was a while ago, and I loved it, and I went back to it, and always knew I wanted to do something with it, but then didn't know what. Like, because I just thought there was something about how it was both about one thing and about everything, and I loved that infinite allegorical aspect of it. I hadn't actually read it in a while, but I went with a delegation of U.S. poets to India to a poetry festival in Calcutta and didn't write anything when I was there, not a word, while everyone else around me was scribbling and writing all about these things happening in India. And I just felt that I was around all these writers and I couldn't write being around writers. I think that's just not how I work. I loved it. I loved talking and reading and meeting all these poets, but I just couldn't write there. And the day I came home,
out of nowhere, I just came up with these little box poems, and it was almost like I had put a chip in my head, and then it just sat there for years. Mm-hmm. And then, for whatever reason, I came back from India and had this whole little prison series, all 8 sections in like 3 days. Mm-hmm. I also maybe was because, you know, I was having some jet lag.
I mean, can you talk a little bit more about the trip or about the festival in Calcutta?
One of the things that was really amazing about the festival is that we had translated, well, collaborated, because I don't speak Bengali, but a poet, Gautam Dutta, who was one of the coordinators for the trip, gave us sort of literal translations, and then we turned them into, you know, more lyrical translations. And that happened with poets who, of course, spoke much more English than American poets going there spoke Bengali. So I got to hear my work translated into Bengali, and read in a reading, and it was so exciting to hear something that was mine read in this language I couldn't understand. And I loved seeing that my poem had taken off into the world without me, and it had its life of its own, and those words, whatever I did with them, became other words and meant other things to other people.
Here's Gautam Dutta reading his translation of Idra Novi's poem Obad for Bina del Mar in Bengali.
Obad for Bina del Mar. ইদ্রা নভি ভিনিয়া দেল মারের জন্য রাগ ললিত একটা নেড়ি কুত্তার পেছনে পেছনে এমন ঘুড়ি যাতে কুত্তাটা বন্ধ করে আমাকে অনুসরণ, আর সেই জন্য একটা ভায়োলিন তৈরি হয় যেন আমার কোট পকেটে, সুরে তার বাঁধার মতো তৈরি নয় আমার কান। এই করতে করতে বেজে গেল সকাল 6টা, তবু আর কিছুক্ষণের মধ্যে আমি মালিক হব একটা সম্পূর্ণ বাদ্যযন্ত্রের যেটা বাজবে জলসায়। এখন প্রায় 7টা বাজে, আর কাঠের একটা অদ্ভুত উড়ু ক্রমাগত খুঁড়ছে আমার একদিক, আর আমার অন্য পকেটে খোঁচায় ভায়োলিনের ধনুক।
You're listening to Gautam Dutta read his translation of Idra Novi's Obad for Bina del Mar in Bengali, which appeared in the poetry magazine Kirtibas. In addition to being a poet and translator, Gautam is also an editor and worked with Yusuf Komunyakaa to create the first African-American poetry anthology in Bengali in 2005. In English, it was called I Do Not Want My Freedom When I Am Dead. Idra, Gautam told me 4 or 5 million people come to the book festival in Calcutta. Can you tell me a little bit more about what that festival is all about, what it's like to read for so many people?
Oh, they were, those 4 million people did not come when we were there because the festival was canceled. But we did all the readings anyway.
Yeah.
So we went around and did readings, and a bunch of people had already flown in from a lot of different countries. So the festival wasn't canceled until we had all already arrived. And yeah. Every newspaper had a different story. But it was something about, I guess the festival was started by micropresses. Uh-huh. And there's like a street near the university there. There's like a long tradition of publishing and of literary life in Calcutta. And all these micropresses started it. But then because 4 million people are coming, it's one of the largest festivals, literary festivals in Asia, mm-hmm. that the bigger presses were trying to cash in on it and charge and change the character of the festival. So there was some butting of heads between the micropresses and like the Penguin bigger presses.
Wow.
Yeah. So anyway, we all flew all the way to Calcutta, this like US Village of Poets, and there was no festival. But all these people from all over the world were there anyway, so we had all these events, and there just wasn't the actual book fairs, which was terrible, I think, for these presses, that's where they make their living for the year.
Idra, before we end, would you read one more poem from Exit Civilian? Would you read Before They Came For Us?
Before They Came For Us. They met in the woods below our homes, brought their sawed-off shotguns and rusted knives, chucked their crushed Budweisers against the trees, and greased their beards. Even their laughter was bad, even their thick feet, filthy in their boots. Did they know about the busted window above our bunk beds, that we'd forgotten to close the garage after we put our bikes away? That time by the creek, did we just pretend to drink the dregs from their cans, or did we sip from them? Did we swallow? Were all of them empty? Was that innocence or the end of it? Was it then we began to sneak into our mother's bed, that we began to watch her sleep?
You've been listening to the Circumference podcast series. I'm Montana Ray. I'd like to say thank you to Paulo Enriquez Brito and Gautam Dutta for sending me audio files to play during this podcast. And a huge thank you to Idra Novi, who is a great writer and translator, but also a really generous facilitator of other people's dreams. So thank you, Idra.
Salve.
Não, não. Senta. Senta. Não, não. Senta. Não, não. Vai sair legal. Senta. Então tem que dançar dançando. Dançando.
Alquimistas estão chegando. Estão chegando os alquimistas. Os alquimistas estão chegando. Estão chegando os alquimistas. Silenciosos, moram bem longe dos homens, escolhem com carinho a hora e o tempo do seu precioso trabalho, são pacientes, assíduos e perseverantes, executam segundo as regras herméticas, desde a trituração, a fixação, a destilação e a coagulação.